Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Shirley Templin, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, I'm home. I always feel so safe here. We've been up here a number of times, and I always enjoy the peacefulness up here. And I thank you for inviting me and my little Al-Anon up here for the weekend. I would like to introduce him. He's my driver. He drove me to drinking. He drove me to treatment. And he drove me up here last night. And you're going to hear rebuttal in the morning, Bo. My sobriety date is July the 29th, 1982. And there ain't a lot of people in this world proud of that, but this little old girl is. Because I do believe I would not be around had I not found the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to share with you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and a lot about what I am about today. And I have to start at the very beginning. I'm the oldest of three children. I have a brother that's 4 years younger than I am, and he's normal. We don't know what that means. He doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he doesn't cuss. He's lived in the same house forever, been married to the same woman forever. What he does for fun, we do not know. And then there's my sister Gail, who's 8 years younger than I am, and she's somewhere in Florida working on her story. Wow. When I was 13 years old, my mom came to me and David and Gail and said, "Pack up all your stuff. We're moving in with your grandparents." They had just divorced. And you know, I thought we got the problem out of the house. That was a really neat feeling of knowing that I didn't have to worry about whether my dad came home or if he did come home. It didn't matter if he came home with money, if he didn't. But we didn't have to worry about him anymore. And we moved in with my grandparents. And man, I was the happiest kid on the block because I was the oldest grandchild and I was spoiled rotten. And I loved every minute of it. You see, my grandparents always had time for me. My mom never did because she was always trying to fix my daddy. And so when we moved in with these grandparents, you know, I can remember my grandmother sitting up at night and hemming a skirt for me or a jumper or a pair of slacks for me to wear to school the next day. And you know what I remember? I remember sitting at the lunch table wondering why I couldn't have something bought. And she made every one of my clothes. You know, she was the one that would let me go to Sunday school with her on Sunday mornings. And I knew I'd be okay living with these grandparents. Well, we moved in with them. That summer I turned 14. I started high school in September. Doing pretty good. First Christmas there with my grandparents was the best Christmas I ever had in my life. My brother and sister and I opened presents all day long. And you see, there were many Christmases in my life up until 13, when I was 13 years old, that I never got presents. We woke up many mornings on Christmas morning and we didn't have anything to open because my daddy never made it home with any money. And my mom would sit around on Christmas Day and cry. And I remember that. I remember waking up thinking, I thought Santa Claus was supposed to come last night. Santa didn't make it to our house. But my grandmother showered us with Christmas presents all day long, and I kept looking over at my mom, and she was not crying. And I thought, wow, we're going to be okay. Well, right after Christmas, this granny that I loved and adored so much was taken by ambulance from the house to the hospital, and she never came home. She died at the age of 50 of cancer, and I didn't understand that. What in the world was I going to do now? And you know, I thought about not having any more homemade clothes. You know, I should have thanked her a little bit more than I did. My granddaddy sat my mother down at the dining room table one night and said, "Louise, if you're going to live here in this house with these three children, honey, you need to get a job." My mom's answer to that was, "Okay, Dad, I'll get a job and we'll move out all the way across town." I didn't understand that at the time, but I understand that today. My mother was making a geographic change. And so we moved out. We moved all the way across Birmingham. And my mom got a job working 3 in the afternoon until 11. And she went to work at this bakery where they made the moon pies. Don't offer me a moon pie. I do not want a moon pie. I've had them cold. I've had them hot. I've had them stuck to the plastic wrappers. I've had them in my lunch boxes. I've had them in my purse. Do not give me a moon pie. But what happened was my mother would work until 11, come home, the three of us would be in bed asleep. Get up the next morning to go to school, my mother would be in bed asleep. So I just took care of David and Gail. You know, I hopped on that 305 bus and came home from school and made sure they had something to eat for supper, made sure they got their bath, did their homework, washed blue jeans. We went to bed. And here I am now, I'm 15, and I've never been out on a date. Wasn't a big deal. We girls sat at the lunch table and talked about all you good-looking hunks. But I never talked to a fella. But I knew my time would come. And so one day a girlfriend of mine said, do you think your mom would let you double date this coming Saturday night? And I thought, well, she doesn't work on Saturday. That's a good sign. So I asked my mom, I said, Mom, could I go out on a blind date on Saturday night with Margaret? And she said, well, Shirley, blind dates just usually don't turn into anything. Well, you'll hear him in the morning at 10 o'clock if you'll come. In fact, last Friday, April 30th, we celebrated 40 years of marriage. And I'm proud of that. Now, I don't remember all of those. But he does, every single one of them. And anyway, I'm getting ready to go out on this blind date, and my mother's giving me some instructions. Number one, Shirley, when he walks you to the door, you do not kiss him goodnight. And I said, why not? She said, good girls don't do that. Well, okay. And we went roller skating, and my mother taught roller skating lessons, okay? And I had this little short skirt, and I had my own little roller skates, and we went roller skating, and sometime that evening, Bo asked me for my telephone number. And you know, in my mind, I was thinking, I can't kiss him goodnight when he walks me to the door. But I gave him my telephone number. And sure enough, we get to my front door, and my mother's got the front porch light on and every light in the house on, and she's standing in there ironing, waiting on me to come in. And Bo reached over to kiss me, and I remembered what my mother said. So I wouldn't let him kiss me, and he said, well, I'll talk to you later. And he left. I put my key in that door and walked in, and my mom said, well, how was it? And I said, you know what, Mom, I'm going to marry him one of these days. And she said, did you kiss him goodnight? I said, no, ma'am, I didn't. She said, well, he probably won't call you back. But he did the next afternoon after church, and he asked me for this date on Sunday night. Now, my curfew was 10 o'clock. No wonder you never got in trouble back then. You didn't have time. So here's my Sunday night date. It's curfew 10 o'clock, and Bo opened up the car door for me, and I slid all the way across the front of that car, no bucket seats. And he goes around and gets in on his side of the car, closes the door, and he put his arm around me, and he kissed me. And bless his heart, he's just been kissing me ever since. And we dated for 5 years. 5 years. That's a long time. That's a lot of kisses. And when we realized that we wanted to get married, we had that one ingredient. We loved each other. And so we made this vow, come heck or high waters, that no matter what we went through, we were going to stay together because we wanted children and we didn't want them to have one parent like each of us had. Bless his heart, he just didn't know the heck and high waters that he was going to have to go through with this little alcoholic. And so we made the commitment. He put that ring on my finger, and the first thing I thought of was calling my dad. Crazy. My first mistake was calling him at night, and he answered the phone, and he had that slur. I said, Dad, this is Shirley, you know, your oldest, and I'm getting married on April the 30th. Will you come and give me away? And he said, why, sure I will, and the hair on my arm stood up. How many times had I heard that? How many times had I heard my daddy say, why, sure I will. I'll be there. But you know what? I believed him. This was different. This was my wedding day, and my dad would not mess up my wedding day. So we get to this big church in Hueytown, and it's got these great big double doors out front, and everyone's seated, and all the candles are lit, and the music's playing, and Bo is down front waiting to come out of that little room with the best man and the preacher, and I'm at the back ready to walk down the aisle, and I don't have a daddy. And my mom is standing there, and once more she's got that look on her face, "Shirley, when are you ever going to learn that your daddy would rather have a drink than have anything to do with you?" And about that time, a couple of guys walked outside on the sidewalk to smoke a cigarette, and I heard one of them say, "Well, buddy, come up on the sidewalk. I don't care. My daddy pulled right up on the sidewalk." I guess he was nervous. He just pulled that car right up on that sidewalk, got out of that car, walked in. Second thing I noticed, that natural glow. Oh, that red face. And I looked at him, and he had those bloodshot red eyes. And I just shook my head, and I said, "No, not this time." My daddy walked right over to me and my mom, and he took one look at my mom, he took one look at me, and he turned around and he walked out. And I said, "I'm not believing this. Who in the world's going to give me away?" And that's when old normal David walked over, and he said, "Come on and pull the veil down over your face. I'll walk you down the aisle. I've been trying to get rid of you for years." And we just let him think he's the reason we've stayed together. And we left that church that night, and the first thing I said in that car was, "We'll not have drinking in our home." And Bo said, "Fine." See, he didn't grow up in that. So we left that church that night on April the 30th, and we started on something called the Great American Dream. Now, we didn't know a lot about life, but buddy, we loved each other, and we knew we could tackle this world. Whatever it threw at us, we'd be able to handle it. And you know, we wanted children, and we wanted children, but we wanted that house first. So we had real good jobs, and the first year we were married, we saved up that down payment for that first little home in Hueytown, the 3 bedrooms, 1 bath, and the great big fenced-in backyard for our kids to learn how to drive. That figure eight is still there in that backyard. But we set out to start having these children. We spent our first wedding anniversary in this pretty little house and no children. Second wedding anniversary rolled around, April 30th, no children. But we were trying. We just weren't having any luck. And third wedding anniversary, Bo pulled into the driveway with me, a little two-door red Thunderbird. Bucket seats. It was a steering wheel that swing steering wheel, okay? I had arrived. It was candy apple red. It didn't hold a lot of groceries. But man, that was a pretty little car. I got up at 5:30 every morning just to go to work. And one day on the way home from work, a man hit me. How dare him? And scraped me all the way down the left side of this car. Well, you couldn't see that scrape. I had to show the scrape to Bo when I got home. And his remark to me was, "Shirley, I want you to go to the doctor, and I want you to have him check you over from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet." And I said, "But Bo, I'm fine." He said, "I know, but you don't have a whiplash in 6 months, or you don't want something to come up because of this accident." I said, "Okay, I'll go to the doctor." Well, back then, you didn't call and make appointments. You went in and signed in, and you waited. That's what I did. I went in and I waited, and about lunchtime they called me in. Me telling the nurses as they were questioning me, "I feel fine. I don't know why I'm here." And so they checked me over from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, and finally the doctor said, "Shirley, go in my office and have a seat. I'll be in there in just a minute." And I'm thinking, why? I'm ready to go home. And he said, "Just go on in there. I'll be in there in just a minute." So I went in there and sat down across from his desk, facing his desk. And I'm sitting there thinking, wonder what he's going to talk to me about. So about that time, the doctor came in, and instead of going over and sitting behind his chair, I'm behind his desk, in his chair, facing me, he just sat in that chair beside me. And he tapped me on the knee, and he said, "Shirley, you're 2 months pregnant." I said, "From the wreck?" And you know, the thought came to my mind, I can't tell Bo. Now see here, all these years we've been trying. And the doctor said, well, get him on the phone, I'll tell him. So I got Bo on the phone and I heard the doctor say, Bo, we've checked Shirley over and she's 2 months pregnant. And Bo said, from the wreck? That's before I started drinking. And that little wreck's name was Mike. He was born November the 10th of that year, the sunshine of my life. A little blonde-headed, blue-eyed hunk. And then I had another wreck, and her name is Sissy. And she's brown-headed, brown-eyed, and lives next door to me, and we can't get rid of them. And that's all the wrecks I had. That was one boy and one girl. That's all the variety they had, so we didn't have any more. And Bo and I were discussing this great American dream one night at dinner, and he said, I think you need to go back to work. And I said, but let me find a babysitter who will take care of these children. And I did. I found a lady that was to come into our lives and be there in place when this disease of alcoholism reared its ugly head. Mama Betty was a godsend. Mama Betty was available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. She would call me at work if the weather was bad and say, don't come out here and pick up these children. You let them spend the night with me. It's too bad outside for you to get them out. Or she would tell me, why don't you and Bo pack a little overnight bag on Friday and just leave the kids here with me and you two go off for the weekend together. When my children got sick, they cried for Mama Betty, because she was just right there with them. And I know today, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that was God taking care of my kids because he knew what was coming down the line and I wasn't going to be able to take care of them. Well, at work one day, I got this good job. I went to work, and one day at lunch, a girl said, we would like for you to join our social sorority. Said, we need another member, and we think you'd be great. And the first thing that dawned on me was, hey, I didn't get to do stuff like that in high school. I had to jump on that 305 bus. I had to get home, take care of that brother and sister. I didn't get to go to pep rallies. I didn't get to go to football games on Friday night. Yeah, I would really like to join your sorority. So I went through the initiation. Later on that summer, one of the girls had a little party down at her lake house right outside of Hueytown on the Warrior River. It's hot. Mama Betty had the children for the weekend. We drive up in this lady's yard that's just immaculately manicured. It has the lights all over the yard, a live band, the moon reflecting off that water, and just a gentle breeze. And my husband walked up to me and handed me the first drink of alcohol that I ever had. He said, here, honey, drink this. And being the good wife, I drank it. Now, I'm an alcoholic who remembers her last drink, and I want to tell you about my first one. It was in a real tall glass, had just a touch of pink to it. It had a toothpick across the top of that glass, and on that toothpick, it had a maraschino cherry with a stem, a slice of orange, and a hunk of pineapple. There was a straw in this glass, and somewhere in that glass was an umbrella. I swear there was. Well, at least that's what it seemed like to me, because when I drank that drink, my fingers started tingling, my toes started tingling. I had things on my body that I didn't know could tingle, and I loved it. I had another one, and I understand that that was a Tom Collins, and I liked that. Well, I would go to these sorority meetings, and my husband would wait up for me. Children would be in bed, and he'd say, well, how was your meeting? And I'd say, well, it was all right. What did you do? I said, well, we got there, and we fixed ourselves a drink. And then we'd do a little business, and we'd take a time out, and we'd fix ourselves a little drink. And then I think we'd finish up everything, and then we'd have another drink before we came home. And he said, I don't think I like for you to be a part of that. I quit. I mean, I resigned. I wasn't even there a year. I mean, I turned in my little pen that my sister had given me, and I said, my husband doesn't want me to be a part of this. It wasn't a problem. But let me tell you what I missed. For a long, long time, I thought alcohol was a stimulant, and that's what it did for me. Now, I would like to share with you that I'm an alcoholic who's never been in jail. I've never had a DUI. I didn't go to bars. I didn't run around. I did all my damage, and a lot of damage, in my home on 28th Avenue in Hueytown. And I'm also a winette. All of you guys who drink wine are winos. I am a winette. And what I would do was get home from work at 4:30, and at 4:35 I had a drink in my hand. I would also like to tell you that I drank Boone's Farm Tickle Pink. Now, you may laugh and you may say, ooh, but it did the job. I would take my son's lunch money out of his blue jeans pocket at night, and I would put 17 cents with it and go buy a bottle at the Quick Mart. I'm not really proud of that. And if she didn't have lunch money in his pocket, I'd go get it out of Sissy's piggy bank. Stealing from my children. And then when they would ask me about it, I'd say, go ask your daddy for some more money. I would go get that bottle and I would pour it in a wine decanter and put it on the left side of my refrigerator. Mike and Cece loved strawberry Kool-Aid, and I kept it made for them in a white Tupperware pitcher on the other side of the refrigerator. And I was real quick to tell them, Mom's Kool-Aid is on the left, your Kool-Aid is on the right. And my daughter Cece is 35 years old today, and my grandchildren will never have Kool-Aid. And that's the smallest scar that my alcoholism put on my daughter. You know, I would come home from work and start drinking, and sometimes I made it through dinner and sometimes I didn't. My daughter would pull the chair up to the stove and finish dinner because Mom had passed out. I used to make it to the bed. A lot of times I made it to the bed. But at the end, I didn't. And it's wherever I passed out, my kids would cover me up with a blanket, and that's where I would stay. I got up one morning and I looked in the mirror in the bathroom and I saw what my daddy looked like on April the 30th, 1964. I had the natural glow about me. I no longer had brown eyes, they were bloodshot red. My hair was like steel wool and I didn't want to live anymore. I did not want to live anymore. I was 38 years old and I had nothing to live for. I had lost the love and respect of my two children and of the man that I wanted to live with for the rest of my life. And I looked in this mirror and I said, you know, God, I don't remember the last time Bo said he loved me. You know, God, I can't remember the last time Mike put his arms around me and said, Mom, you smell so good. And God, I don't remember the last time Sissy gave me a compliment. And this little voice came back and it said, hey, Shirley, when was the last time you told Bo you loved him? Hey, Shirley, when was the last time you put your arms around Mike and you told him he smelled good? And Shirley, what about the last time you gave Sissy a compliment? I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Call me anything in the world, but I'm not as bad as my dad. You know, I drank in my kitchen, I didn't bother anybody. And my mother-in-law would call and I'd hang up on her because she said something to me about my drinking. And I would say to her, listen, I'm taking care of your son and your two grandchildren. Click. The last time I heard from my mom, on my last drunk, I called my mom to tell her that I wanted to pack a bag and come out and live with her for a little while. And would that be okay? And my mom's response to that was, Shirley, of my three children, you're the sorriest. And I wouldn't count on you if you're the only thing I had to count on. And Mike and Sissy deserve a better mother than what they've got. No, ma'am, you cannot come out here. Click. And my family members were going to a ball game in July of 82. And one more time, they didn't ask me to go, and I didn't want to go. They would be gone for a few hours and I could do what I wanted to do without them looking over my shoulder. And Sissy and Bo were already in the car, ready to leave. And Mike was at the door and forgot his hairbrush that stuck out his right blue jeans pocket. And he went back to his room to get the hairbrush. And as he got to the front door, now Mike is 15. He's about a half of a head taller than me. And he looked at me and he said, Mom, when we get home tonight, are you going to be passed out in the floor or passed out in bed? And my hand got right here. to slap my son's teeth out. How dare him make a remark like that to me? And as I started with my hand to slap Mike, something flashed in front of my eyes about the last time that my daddy beat me with a belt buckle end of his belt. And I hollered at him and I said, "Dad, if God ever allows me to have children, I swear I'll never lay a hand on them." And for one split second, I had my hand right here to slap Mike. And you know what scares me so? I could have killed him. I was so mad for him making a statement about my drinking. Slap didn't have to happen. Mike left. He went and got in the car with his dad and Sissy, and they went to the ball game. And the thing that dawned on me was in this hand I had a glass of wine. So I went back in the kitchen and I filled it back up. Came back to the living room to close the front door so I could get on with what I wanted to do. And there was a telephone number that came on the TV screen that was not on. And it said, "If you or someone you love has a problem with alcohol, call this number." And I got the Yellow Pages, and I had the phone, and I called this number all the time, flipping through these Yellow Pages trying to figure out where I'd called. And it rang down in the nurse's station, and a lady named Marion, bless her heart, a lady named Marion answered, and she said, "May I help you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I have a girlfriend with a drinking problem." One more time. And about that time, I found that ad in the Yellow Pages, and it said, "Four cottages nestled in the woods, three men's cottages, one female cottage, 28-day program, family-oriented." And I said to this lady, I said, "If you'll tell me how to get up there, I'll come up there tonight. My family's gone for a few hours. I can pack my bag. I can come up there, and you tell me where to park, and I'll come up there and stay 28 days, and then I'll come home." She kind of chuckled, and she said, "Shirley, honey, I don't think I'd come up here tonight." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, we have snakes." I said, "Snakes?" And she said, "Well, we have this little path that you have to leave your car at the top of the hill and walk down this little one-vehicle path. And a lot of our people want to go AMA at night, but they always come back if it's after dark because of the snakes." And I said, "I believe I'll wait till in the morning. Thank you so very much." And so I gave her everything. I gave her my Sears charge number. Can you believe that? I figured if you get everything else serviced with Sears, why couldn't you get treatment? And I laugh about that today. I see Marion an awful lot. And the first thing she says is, "Sears charge card." But anyway, I waited on Bo and Mike and Cece to come in. And I was so proud. I didn't have another drink. That was my last drink. And I waited on Bo and Mike and Cece walked in the door first, and she said, "Mom, you're up." And I said, "Cece, I've called a treatment center. I've got to have some help with my drinking." And she said, "Yes, ma'am." And she went down the hall to her bedroom and closed the door. Mike comes in. Now, you would never thought anything had happened. He came in, and he said, "Mom, you're up." And I said, "Mike, I've called a treatment center, son. I've got to have some help with my drinking." And he said, "Yes, ma'am." And he walked down the hall to his bedroom, and he closed the door, and he did that click. He put that lock on it, which told me, "Don't come in my room, Mom." And then old Bo comes in, and I think he said something like, "Oh, you're up." And I said, "Bo, I've called a treatment center. I've got to have some help with my drinking." And he looked at me, and he said, "Honey, this is number 1,382. What's different?" And he went and took a shower and went to bed. Now, this was the time I meant business. It's like Jim Dee always said, you can have instant flakes up on a pantry shelf, but until you take them down and you add liquid, you ain't got mashed potatoes. Well, I never had mashed potatoes because I never did anything except this one time. This is when I meant business, and my family didn't believe me. Can you believe that? Well, they get me ready to go to this treatment center, and I was going to go for 28 days and come home and live happily ever after. Well, I went and stayed 38 days. And when I got there and got a little detoxed, you know, I told them maybe I really didn't have a problem. You know, when you start feeling better, you don't think you have a problem. And I remember my counselor saying, "Shirley, if you can't believe anything at all, why don't you believe that Blue Cross Blue Shield is paying for you to be here? And if it wasn't a disease, they wouldn't be paying." And I said, "I know, but you know." And she said, "Well, do this for me. Go to your room and write down some of the things that you've done to your family." Well, that did it. All the things I'd done to my family. How I embarrassed my kids at their ball games, fall off the bleachers, pull right up on first base in my car, headlights on and everything. Take them to school and run out of gas and only have my gown on. I did all kinds of stuff. Yeah, I had a problem. I am a real alcoholic, and I've roared through the lives of my family members 10 times more than I would have ever imagined until I put it on paper. Well, they had something up there called Family Week, and Bo loves to talk about it, so I'm going to let him tell about it, except for one little thing. They had us all in a room. Sissy's 13, Mike's 15, and you know those two kids need to be in somebody's backyard in a swimming pool. They don't need to be up in Warrior, Alabama, at a treatment center for their alcoholic mom. And the counselor goes over to Mike and said, "Mike, honey, what do you want to do with your mom?" And he said, "I don't know, but I don't want another mother. I want this same mother. I just don't want her to drink anymore." Wow. Was this the little boy that I almost hit? And then the counselor went over to Sissy and said, "Sissy, what do you want to do with your mom?" And she said, "I don't know, but I'm 13 years old and I want to be somebody's little girl. I'm so tired of tucking my mother in bed at night or covering her up on the floor. I'm tired of her taking my money out of my piggy bank. And I don't want to go to Bonnie's house across the street and get my hair brushed anymore. I want my mom to brush my hair." And I thought, I never beat them with the belt buckle into the belt, but I took away their growing up years. My daughter's left-handed and she could never load the dishwasher right. I'd wake her up in the middle of the night and tell her if she couldn't do it the way I wanted it done, don't do it. Or I'd open up the linen closet and she had dried all the sheets and towels and washcloths and folded them and put them in the linen closet. And I'd wake her up and I'd say, "Sissy, if you can't fold them the way I want them folded, don't do it." I cut her down every way I could. I told her if she made better grades at school, I wouldn't drink. She made the honor roll. Well, the counselor went over to Bo and said, "What do you want to do with your wife?" And he said, "I don't know, but you can have her. We're 18 and a half years into a marriage that I ain't going to make it to number 19. And for the first time, I realized just how much damage I had done. And so they all left and went home, and I remember my counselor waking me up at 3 a.m. with a flashlight in my face and saying, "Come down to my office, I want to talk to you." And you know, I thought I was the only one she did this way. She did all of us that way. But she sat me down in her office and she said, "Now, Shirley, when you get out of here, if you will get completely involved in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I guarantee you that everything in your life will fall into place." And I said, "Does that mean I'll get my family back together?" She said, "Well, I don't know. It's whatever God's plan is. But I can guarantee you that if you will put your sobriety first, everything else in your life will fall into place." And she said, "And I think that for you, you need to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous immediately. Just like when you get out of treatment, you've got to go straight to an AA meeting." And I said, "You mean they have these things on holidays?" And she said, "I'm serious. If you will put AA first in your sobriety, you'll be okay." Well, I got out of treatment on Labor Day weekend, 1982. And we were directed to go to the Bessemer Group. And the Bessemer Group is my home group, and it has been my home group since that day. I think it's the best group in the whole wide world. I hope you feel that way about yours. But we went and we met up with people and went to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, down the road about 50 miles to their AA Al-Anon anniversary. Been to every one of them since. They've never had a program like they had Labor Day, 82. They had a male Al-Anon speaker and a female AA speaker. Never had that combination since. Now, I can't tell you a word that the Al-Anon said. I don't even know who he was, where he was from. I don't know what he looked like. But we had him share, and then we had a dinner, and then they opened up the AA portion. And this lady got up there, and I fell in love with her instantly. Now, Mike's sitting across from me, and Bo is over there, and Sissy's next to me, and this lady gets up, and she says, "Hi, my name's Marty, and I'm an alcoholic." And Mike looked at Sissy, and Sissy looked at Bo and said, "Wow, there's two of them in this world, her and our mother." And we laughed. For the first time in years, the Templin family laughed. And wow, I hung on to every word that lady said. It sounded like she knew what she was talking about, you know? And we left that anniversary that night, and we went back to the Bessemer group, and everybody got in their own cars, and we went home, and it had been 38 days since I had left. And my kids had a 2-pound bag of chocolate chip cookies, and Bo got a gallon of milk. And somebody grabbed four glasses, and the four of us sat in our den floor in the living room with the drapes open and the front door open, and we talked about y'all. We didn't know what you had, but man, it was so much better than what we had. And the four of us made a conscious commitment that night to give this thing our best shot. And we talked until the sun came up. Now, you ask me how I know the sun came up. The drapes were open and the front door was open, and we hadn't closed them since. We asked Mike and Sissy to go to four Alateen meetings, one a week for 4 weeks, and then that we would talk. Where was the strongest, oldest Alateen group in the state of Alabama in 1982? Bessemer. Right there waiting on my kids. Mike went to his four Alateen meetings, and we sat him down and asked him what he thought. And he said, "Well, Mom, it's just not for me." He said, "Now, when you get one of those little round things, one of those little chips, I'll go because they serve cake. And if you and Dad ever go to those parties at the beach, you know, Panama City and Fort Walton and all those, I'll go. But Mom, it's just not for me." You see, he was 15, he was good looking, he had a motorcycle, and he had something called chasing to do. And we believe he caught a lot of times. But Mike was, let me tell you about Mike. He had a program. When you live in a home where there's active alcoholism, you're affected. When you live in a home where the program is practiced, you're affected. And there were many days that Mike and Cece would come in from school, and one of them would say, "My bedroom or yours?" And they'd go in there and close the door, and about an hour later they'd come out and I'd say, "Hey guys, what was that all about?" And Mike would say, "Close meeting, Mom." And that's okay. My little boy had a program. Sissy went to her Alateen meetings and fell in love with it. She was 13 years old. And you know, every chance I get, I like to thank Alateen for saving my daughter's life. Because when I was sober 2 years, Bo and I found out that she had been contemplating suicide the summer I got sober. And she had told all of her friends at school that she wouldn't be there. She couldn't stand the pain. She stayed in Alateen until she was 20. Came right on at Al-Anon. She's 35 years old with 21 and a half years of Alateen Al-Anon. And she's the kid that used to tell me, "When I get out of school, color me gone, Mom. I want out of your life. I want out of your hair." Period. Lives next door to me, and we cannot get rid of her. But anyway, so Bo and Sissy and Mike and I are on this journey. And my mom called one night, and she said, "Oh, you know, Shirley, I have what your grandmother had. And in order for me to live, I've got to go on the kidney dialysis." And I said, "Mom, we'll do this one day at a time." And so my mom went on this kidney dialysis, and my sponsor had told me that I needed to be there every Monday and Friday night when my mom hooked up to the kidney machine. And I said, "But you don't understand. A lot of times, Bo and I are out of town on weekends." She said, "Not until after your mother comes off that machine." I said, really? And she said, yes, ma'am. And I said, well, what? How do I start this process of making these amends to my mom? Because, see, nothing had been said about that last time we talked on the phone and she hung up. And Katie says, well, honey, all you have to do is just be there. Miracles happen if you just show up. And for 3.5 years, I sat with my mother on Monday and Friday nights while she hooked up to the kidney dialysis. And one night we were sitting there and my mother said to me, Shirley, of my 3 children, you've turned out to be the best. You are the only one who's been here with me every single night that I've hooked up to this machine. And I can count on you. I don't care what you tell me. I can count on you. And Mike and Cece couldn't have a better mother if they searched the whole world over. And I love you. My mom made an amends to me because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I had to do was show up. Wow. My mom died 1 month later, a month before my 5th AA birthday. And my mom was going to give me my chip that night. Instead, Cece filled in and she said, you know, I'm filling in for my grandmother who had a date with God. And so Cece gave me my 5-year medallion. And there standing at the back of the clubhouse in Bessemer was my son standing at the counter with tears coming down his eyes saying, I am so proud of you. You see, Mike had flunked the year I got sober. He had flunked that whole year previous. And so when we came home on that Labor Day weekend from Tuscaloosa, my kids go to school on Tuesday, and Mike has to repeat this whole grade that he's flunked. I had a problem with that. I could not look at him in the eyes. I could tell him that I love him, and I could hug his neck, but I could not look at him in the eyes because, you see, I felt I had taken away 1 year of his life. He came home from school one day, and he says, you know, Mom, it's not such a bad deal. You ought to see who's sitting next to me in English. I'd have missed it if I'd gone on up that other grade. Then he came in one day and he says, you know, I'm the smartest one in the class. It's not such a bad deal repeating all this. I'm going to be just fine. And I still had that problem. Came home one afternoon. He had the announcement of the prom. And he walked in the door counting on his fingers. And I said, what is it? And he said, well, I'm trying to figure out how I pay for flowers, how I pay for pictures, how I buy dinner, how I put gas in my car, how I rent a tux. Mom, I don't think with my part-time job I can do that. And I said, well, I'll pay for it. And he said, I'll go. And he went and had a ball a couple of days before the prom. He said, could you show me a couple of little steps or something that I could just get out there and move? I don't want to just be standing there. But we don't want Dad and Cece to see me. So one afternoon when they were not home, I turned on the stereo and Mom and son got a little couple of moves going, and he went to the prom and had a ball. 1 month later, graduation. House full of people. 90% of them, y'all, except for my brother David, normal David. And he kept wanting to know, how much did that one give Mike? How much money was in that envelope for Mike? And I'd say, well, it was this much. I've got to give some more. Every time my brother turned around, he was given more money because he had not given that much. And so sometime that evening, Mike said, I need to talk to you in my room, Mom. And I wondered, why? We've already paid for your trip to Florida. You're graduating in an hour. So he kept on. He said, Mother, I need to talk to you just for a few minutes before graduation in my room. And I thought, hit me up for another loan. So we start back toward his room, and as we pass by the front door, there's 5 cans of beer sitting on the front step. As smart as I am, I said, Mike, what's that? And he said, well, Mother, it's 5 cans of beer. I said, but who does it belong to? He said, well, all of my buddies wanted to come to my party. They loved the food. And I explained to them that we didn't allow alcohol in our home anymore, that they should leave it outside and then they could pick it up when they leave. I promise you, Mom, they'll pick it up when they leave. And Mom, there's one guy here that I said, if he didn't behave, you'd take away his car keys. I said, you didn't. He said, yeah. So back to Mike's bedroom we go. And he's got on his white graduation gown, you know, without the cap, but he's got on that white gown. And we walk into his bedroom, and he motions for me to sit down on his bed. I said, "This must be serious." He said, "It is." And he turned around and he closed the door. And he came over to me and he said, "Mom, I need to tell you three things. And I have to tell them to you before graduation. So here goes. Number one, I want to thank you for being sober. I am so proud of you. I wouldn't be having this party tonight if you weren't sober. Everybody here is our friends of yours and dad's in the program. And I just wanted to say I'm proud of you." Wow. I thought of the promises in the big book, and for so long I thought of myself as junk. You see, I didn't deserve a second chance. And I looked at Mike and he said, "All right, here comes number two." For a long time, you and I have had this glass wall up between us. "You blame yourself for this year that I flunked." And I said, "Yeah, Mike, I do. If I had not been drunk every night, you would have had a place to come home and study and not have to flunk." And he said, "Mom, let me tell you something. I flunked myself. I'm the one that showed up at school. I knew what I was supposed to do. I used your drinking as an excuse. Mom, you're not responsible." He said, "And I know every time you tell me you love me, you cannot look at me in the eyes." He said, "That's fixing to change." Because he said, "When I get that diploma in just a few minutes, every bit of this is going to go away. That glass wall is going to come down because, Mom, I'm right where I need to be right now. I have a full-time job waiting on me when I get back from Florida. I have a new car sitting out in the driveway. I have a motorcycle on the patio. And, Mom, I might not have today what I have if I had graduated last year. So there's not going to be any more discussion on this year. Do you understand?" And so I started to get up. He said, "I said three things." I said, "Well, I don't know what in the world number three could be." He said, "It's better than one or two." He said, "No matter how many little girls I date, you'll always be my number one girl." Wow, I didn't know what to do except just stand up and put my arms around him. And he put his arms around me, and that glass wall went down. It never came back up. Well, we went on to graduation. He got his diploma. Next year, Sissy graduates. Same party, same brother. Only Sissy's going to college, so she was getting gifts that she could use at college. And so I kept watching my watch, and I told Bo, I said, "Wonder when she's going to call me into her room." And Bo said, "I don't think that's going to happen." I said, "Well, I'm sure it is. It happened with Mike." And he said, "Shirley, you and Sissy had your time long time ago." And we did. When she had been in Alateen 7 months, she came in from school one day and she said, "I need to talk to you." No, let me rephrase that. "My sponsor tells me that in order to get better, I've got to share with you all of the things you did to me when you were drunk or in a blackout. And to the best of my knowledge, right now, I have it all written down on a legal pad, and I am to sit with you and tell you everything that you did to me when you were drinking or in a blackout." So we went in her bedroom, got up in the middle of her canopy bed, and sat Indian-legged, and for 2 hours, she read off of this legal pad all the things that I had done to her and said to her when I was drunk or in a blackout. And when she got through and folded all the pages, I said, "Sissy, I am so sorry. I am so sorry. I don't know what else to say." And she said, "Mom, that's all you have to say. It'll never be brought up again." Strong program. Sissy wanted to go to college, and she came to me and her dad and said, "I've got to go to college." And I said, "Sissy, we don't have the money. I drank it up." And she said, "But you don't understand. I've talked to some professors at school, and they've told me that I have all of the on-the-job training. I just need the book knowledge." And I said, "What is it you want to do?" And she said, "I want to be an alcohol counselor. I want to, if I can save one family from going through what we went through." We found the money. We sent that kid to college, and she went to Montevallo, which is 40 miles from us, not long distance, but yet she could live on campus and come home every weekend, and I could wash her clothes and she could raid the refrigerator. And so she started out at Montevallo, and she was a little homesick. She called and said, "I don't like it down here without you." And I said, "Excuse me?" And she said, "I don't have you waking me up in the morning and telling me you love me. And I don't like it down here without you." Wow. So on Wednesdays when I'd get in from work, I'd make her a big batch of brownies. And I said, "Mike, would you mind running these down to your sister?" "Don't mind at all, Mom." And she would call and say that they were still warm when he got them down there. So one evening when he got home, I said, "I need to pay for your gas." I said, "That's 40 miles down there and 40 miles back. And I think that's awesome for a brother to want to do that for his sister." He said, "Mom, in your big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you've highlighted a sentence that says, be willing to go to any length to get it, and I'm just checking out all the girls on her dorm floor." And that was Mike. Well, he came to me and his dad and said, "Can I move Sissy home?" This was Mother's Day weekend, 88. And my remark was, "Why don't you let your dad rent a U-Haul it and make one trip?" And he said, "Mother, you take all the fun out of everything. I have those five buddies with pickup trucks, and we want to move Sissy home. All you have to do is fix us lunch." I said, "Well, I can do that." So that's what they did. All those little pickup trucks came and unloaded everything in the living room. We had to make a path. And I said, "Don't you think we need to move some of this stuff out a little ways?" And Mike says, "Well, I have to move her out in August. It'll be easier for me to pick it up here." So we left it right there, smack dab in the living room. And we were going to do something in a week that most alcoholics don't do. We were going to go on vacation. We already had it planned. We were going by Amtrak to Washington, D.C. And we were going to, as soon as Sissy came home that weekend, we were going to get packed that week and leave the following week for Washington, D.C. But you see, we didn't have that chance. Because May 17th, which will be 16 years this coming Monday week, Bo and I and Sissy had to open the doors at 12:30 to three policemen to tell us that Mike had been killed instantly by a drunk driver. And my whole world absolutely went to pieces. I thought of all the times that I was drunk, and if somebody had called and said, "Shirley, he's laying in a ditch," I couldn't have gone. I remember calling Katie. And she came over to my house and she said, "Sweetie, you won't ever be fine again. You're going to be okay." She made a list on another legal pad of 3-hour shifts, and every girl at Bessemer was supposed to come to my house at a different time for 72 hours. There were some girls at Bessemer who had not even been sober 30 days. And I remember some of them coming in, and I'd say, "What is your name?" And she'd tell me, and I'd say, "What are you doing here?" "I don't know. That Katie said this was my 3 hours." And they said, "All I'm supposed to do is keep an eye on you and lay down with you if you lay down, or if you go get on Mike's motorcycle, get on the motorcycle. And I'm supposed to get you to eat a cracker or a piece of cheese, and I'm just supposed to love you." And you see, I wouldn't have made it because my husband was in the bedroom loading a shotgun to go kill a drunk driver. And it was Jim D. who came in there and said, "Bo, you can't do that. Don't you see what you're doing?" And Bo said, "You don't understand the pain. You don't understand. I wouldn't have made it. I wouldn't be here tonight if Katie had not sent a girl over for me, because you see, I didn't want to live. I didn't want to drink. There's never been a time in my sobriety that I have ever wanted to drink. But let me share something with you. There have been so many times in my life when I didn't want to live. People ask us all the time how you do it. You put one foot in front of the other and you stay real close together. That marriage that was 18 and a half years, not going to make it to number 19. I honestly believe there's not anything in this world that Bo and I cannot walk through together, period. I think we're living proof of that. And I love him more today than I ever, ever dreamed possible that I could love him. Sissy went back to college. She went back for Mike. She went to class enough that they gave her a degree. And at graduation that night, she asked me and her dad, she said, "Can I move back home?" And I went back to Katie and I said, "What do I do? I don't want to smother her." And she said, "Well, she will tell you when you're smothering her." Well, she never did. She loved all the attention. But then Sissy was self-supporting through her own contributions. She got a job. And she got a job doing what she wanted to do, working with alcoholics. She came home from work one afternoon. She says, "You know, Mom, everybody, all my girlfriends have boyfriends. They're getting married. They're having babies," not necessarily in that order. But she said, "I want to be a part of that. And do you think there's ever going to be a man for me?" And I said, "Sure I do, Sissy. I just don't think God's through with him." And she said, "Well, when do you think God's going to be through with him?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know. What's your criteria? Share with me what you want in a man." Number one, she said, "I want somebody like my dad." And I said, "You won't find anybody like him. Because you have to live the life to be like your dad. It just doesn't happen." She said, "Well, then let me tell you what else I want, page two. I don't want anybody with a ponytail. I don't want anybody with an earring. And I do not want anybody who's been married before with children." I said, "Sissy, that's a pretty strong order for God." And she said, "Well, that's what I want." Well, old Bob comes riding into her life, and he doesn't come riding into her life with a financial statement. Bob comes riding into her life on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with a ponytail, an earring, and two children. Go figure. And so she calls me and she says, "I have this date with this young man." And I go home and we get her ready for the date. And as she's getting ready to leave, I say to her, "Now, Sissy, when he walks you to the door..." She said, "Mother, don't tell me that I can't kiss him goodnight at the door." I said, "Well, Sissy, why don't you try not kissing him? It worked for me in 1959. She said, "Oh, Mother, things have changed. It ain't going to fly now. It might have flown back then, but it's not going to fly." I said, "Well, why don't you try it?" And so she leaves for her date, and there it's about time for them to come back home, and I have all the outside lights on. And I hear her put her key in the door, and I hear giggling. I'm thinking she's kissed him goodnight. And I run, get in bed, and wake Bo up, and I hear all the lights turn out and her tiptoeing down the hall, and she knocks on the door and she comes in and slides right up between us and she says, "Hey, Mom, is it possible to fall in love on your first date?" I said, "Bo, get up. We got to make the coffee." And old Bob has this 5-year-old son and an 9-year-old daughter. And Will and Kale and Bob and Cece and all of us decide they're going to get married at the same church Bo and I married. And I had a counselor in treatment, an ordained minister at Howard. And some of you were there. But we had this wedding where we opened with a serenity prayer. We lit a candle for Mike because, you see, he's just in another room. We closed with the Lord's Prayer. We had Howard up there doing a Methodist wedding ceremony in a Baptist church wearing a black Catholic robe. And my husband, to this day, has a resentment because I would not let him pass the basket. And it was a house full. So anyway, Bob and Sissy get married, and we have the big house out in Hueytown. And it's an awful lot to take care of when you don't have everybody there. And it's got a pool and two stories and a lot of yard. And so one day, Bo and I mentioned to Bob and Sissy that we'd like to sell the big house and start downsizing to get ready to retire and move out in the country somewhere. And Bob and Sissy said, "Fine with us, as long as you take us with you." And I knew in my heart and every other part of my body that it wasn't going to work, two people and two families under one roof. So we go out to West Blockton, and where the pavement and the dirt road meet is where you turn into Serenity Hill. It's better known as Templin Country. Bob and Sissy's last name's Country, but the big sign says Templin Country. And Bo and Shirley have a new house on the top of the hill. Bob and Sissy have one 1/3 of the way down the hill, and we use the same driveway. And things started to get back like they ought to, okay? And Cece had been having headaches since Mike died, been to every doctor in the world. And all he said was, I can control the headaches, but I can't cure them. And one of our Christmases there in the new houses, Cece was opening presents, and she did that. And I said, what's wrong with you? And she said, it was like an ice pick over my right eye. We called the doctor, and he did a series of tests, including the MRI, and found at the base of my daughter's brain an aneurysm just sitting there, just growing. And when they got the test results back, they'd been sent to the wrong doctor. Bo and I were out of town. We just assumed that everything was fine. We didn't hear. We were out of town. We got in, jumped in the van. It was pouring down rain. My husband's beating on the steering wheel, cussing God, cussing me, everything. And he's saying, God, you've got my little boy. You cannot have my little girl. And it was almost like a hand came down on my shoulder and it said, Shirley, honey, you're going to be okay. You've been through the darkest, the deepest, the coldest tunnel that a mom could go through. You'll get through this. And I just reached over and told Bo, I said, honey, if you'll pull this van over, I'll drive home. He said, you can't drive in the rain. I said, yes, I can now. I'm okay. And I drove us home. And Cece had brain surgery. They shaved my little girl's head. And I remember thinking, I'm so grateful that we didn't lose her, but why is this happening to us? What are we not doing? What are we not doing? And then, of course, Katie has died, and I didn't have a sponsor, and I got this gal that said, I'll walk with you. And I called her, and I said, what is it that I'm doing wrong? She said, Shirley, you're not doing anything wrong. This is called life. And what you've got to understand is that you're living it right now according to your terms, not God's. And what you've got to do is realize that he's going to take care of you. You know, every day when I got up to go to work, I'd fix Cece a lunch, a breakfast and a lunch. She was a couch potato, and I'd hang it on her doorknob, and I'd go on to work. And every morning I'd put a little note in there like, you are the sunshine of my life. Or some song by George Strait or some little saying, and stick it right in there with the lunch. And that Christmas of 99, after her surgery and after she had recuperated and gone back to work, she gave me for Christmas a notebook that had every one of those notes in it that were put on her computer, put 8.5 by 11 size, and on the side outside it said, my mother's love notes to me, I'm giving back my love notes to my mom. Where do you get that? You get them in rooms like this full of people like us. You know, I would like to tell you that everything today is perfect. But it's not. My husband has some health problems. And you see, I don't remember in the marriage vows it saying that Bo was going to take care of Shirley forever. Okay? What I heard was, whether thou goest, I will go. Whether thou lodgest, I will lodge. And so what Bo and I have had to do the last couple of years is I get up in the morning and get to go to work, and my husband stays at home. And I used to say that I wanted to grow old with Bo. We're there. We have arrived. But I can't think of anything that we're supposed to be doing that we're not doing today. We have a really good life today. We have a lot of fun. We really enjoy, you know, coming up here last night. It was absolutely what we were supposed to be doing. Not too long ago, someone called and asked me to come to Cullman. And I love the Cullman group. It's above a pool hall. It's got naked light bulbs hanging from the ceiling. It's got couches down the sides with the springs up where the newcomers sit. I love Cullman. And so, I said I'd come. I hung up the phone and Bo said, we got to go. I said, but that was tonight, wasn't it? He said, yeah, we have to get dressed and go. And I went right back into being someone that's not happy, joyous, and free. I had made a commitment, and I really didn't like it. I wanted to stay at home. And Bo says, well, only thing I'm supposed to do is get you there. I'm your driver, so get dressed. Let's go. And we get on the road, and it's raining. Closer we get to Coleman, the harder it rains. And one time my husband pulled over the side of the road, and he says, "You know, I just don't think you have anything to be grateful for, do you?" I said, "Right now, Bo, I don't. I'm sorry, but I don't." I said, "I had so many irons in the fire at home, and I really needed to get them done." And he said, "How important is it?" "Oh, well, I'm just a driver. What do I know?" So he pulled back on the interstate, 65, and up to Coleman we get. And we get there, and there's no place to park. And he says, "You jump out." I said, "Are you coming in?" He said, "I don't know." So I get out, and I run up the stairs, and they're saying the Serenity Prayer. And I go down front, and they call me up. And I get to the part about Mike. And there's this young man on the front row, and he puts his head down in his lap, and he starts crying. Never had that happen. And I look around the room, and I don't see Bo anywhere. And you see, he's my strength. I kind of have to have him. I'm going to be okay as long as he's in the room. And this little boy is still crying. And about that time, I see Bo come in, and he's wet. He comes around and he stands in the corner, and I guess he knows I'm wondering what to do, and he kind of winks at me, which tells me to go on. And I finish, and as soon as I get through, this young man just kind of picks me up, and he says, "Miss Templin, I'm so glad to see you." I said, "Well, do I know you?" He said, "Yes, ma'am, you know me." I said, "Well, I can't place you." And he said, "Well, I graduated from school with Mike." I said, "You did?" He said, "I was at Mike's party." And I'm thinking, one of the cans of beer. He said, "No, ma'am, I was the one with the car keys." And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" He said, "Well, 2 weeks after graduation, I ran into Mike, and he had a piece of paper, and he had your number on it. He said, if you ever decide you want some help with your drinking, call my mom." I said, "You never have, had you? Have you?" And he said, I never thought it was that bad. I said, "Well, again, what are you doing up here?" And he said, "Well, my family's kicked me out. I have no place to go, and I'm up here in a halfway house." And I said, "Why are you here at this meeting?" And he said, "Well," he said, "there's a rule that the van won't leave unless all the seats are full." And the horn tooted the first time, and I said, "I ain't going." And the horn tooted the second time, I said, "I'm not going." The horn tooted the third time, and I had my tennis shoes in my hand, and out the door I went. And I said, "Well, do you think you have a problem?" He said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." And I said, "Well, I'll make a deal with you. When you come back to Hueytown, if you'll call me, I'll take you to a meeting." I've never heard from him. But let me tell you what I did when I got back in the van. I made an amends to my husband and thanked him for not turning that van around. Because you see, that was another one of those deals about Mike. I would have missed it. And my little boy sends me messages all the time. It's amazing. I love it. I see a penny on the ground, and it's Mike saying, "Hi, Mom, I love you." And you know, I have to think that way because I really think if I didn't, I'd lose my mind. You see? God's put four hunks in my life. Four hunks. My husband, my driver, my lover, the father of my children. I absolutely don't know what I'd do without him. I love growing old with him. The second hunk is that star that was outside last night, the one that went all the way across the sky. That's Mike. And he would have been just as fine a daddy and just as fine a husband because he was a chip off the old block. The third hunk is that young man who came riding into my daughter's life on that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all he told us was, "All I have to offer her is that I can love her. I can love her." The fourth hunk is a young man who recorded a song. His name is Ronnie Millsap. And Ronnie Millsap's producer of this song, Tom Collins. And when they were recording this song, it took 8 takes. Because the drummer had a family member dying of cancer, and every time they get to the verse of it, he quit playing. And finally, Ronnie Millsap said, "We gotta do it this time, and it's gonna be the one." So number 8. And I'm gonna close with a verse of this song that will sum up Shirley Templin in a nutshell. And it goes like this: What a difference you made in my life. What a difference you made in my life. You're my sunshine day and night. Oh, what a difference you made in my life. That's my AA. Thank you, and I love you.